like unto a rod. And one said, Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. And what we were doing the last time is we were looking at two passages in the Old Testament where there was a similar thing that happened, where a reed was taken and measured, used to measure the temple of God. One of those is Ezekiel. So in Ezekiel 43, we were looking at this passage. So we'd like for you to look at Ezekiel 43 for just a moment. Let's look at these other two occasions when a reed was used for measuring, in order that we can see a parallel here. In Ezekiel 43, beginning in verse 10, God says to Ezekiel, Thou, son of man, show the house, meaning the temple. Now, this temple that Ezekiel is being shown in Ezekiel 40 through 48 is not a literal temple that's going to be built. This literal temple was never built. There was never a temple built like this. The temple that was built when the children of Israel came back in 536, it was not remotely like this. And the other circumstances that are described in connection with the portions of land that were allotted, There was never anything even remotely like that. In fact, as you read the description of the land that was given, it would be obvious pretty quickly that there could never be any literal land like that, because it was divided into parallel strips, and every strip was the same. Well, the fact is that if you are familiar with the curving coastland of Palestine, if you had parallel strips, there is no way they could be the same, because the ones in the north would be shorter. And the ones in the south would be longer, because the coast curves like that. And there are just several things that indicate that this is a symbolic thing. Even though it is done in great detail, it is a symbolic thing. And it is symbolic of the new spiritual temple, the new spiritual arrangement that God was going to have after the days of captivity. And both Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Isaiah and other of the prophets were looking beyond the day of mere physical return from captivity. They were also looking to the spiritual renovation that God was going to bring about in the day of the Messiah. So here in chapter 43, verse 10, Ezekiel, Thou, son of man, show the house to the house of Israel. And earlier he talks about this house being built upon the very highest of mountains. Well, remember also Isaiah chapter 2 and Micah 4, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established above the mountains. It'll be the highest of the mountains. So this is all fitting in together with all of that. So in verse 10, Thou, son of man, show the house to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the pattern. It's just simply a matter of look what you have done and look what you should be. That's what the standard is for. A standard is to determine what you should be. You get out and you begin to execute whatever you're doing. And the pattern and the measurement is for you to check yourself and see if you're doing what you are supposed to, if you're doing what you plan to do. So, you show the house, meaning the house as it should be, to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities and let them measure the pattern. And if they be ashamed of all that they have done, make known unto them the form of the house and the fashion thereof and the egresses thereof, in other words, the exits, and the entrances thereof and all the forms thereof. But now then, notice, and all the ordinances thereof, and all the forms thereof and all the laws thereof, and write it in their sight, that they may keep the whole form thereof, and all the ordinances thereof and do them. This is the law of the house. Upon the top of the mountain, the whole limit thereof round about shall be most holy. Behold, this is the law of the house. We're going to look at another passage here in just a moment in chapter 44. But you will see that the concern of God in this passage, as well as in just, I don't even know, I haven't counted how many passages there are in the prophets. But the emphasis is upon the holiness that is to characterize the new house, the new temple. You remember when we studied Hebrews, we studied the letter to the Hebrews. What was one of the startling points made in the letter to the Hebrews about the priesthood under the new covenant? I'll give you a minute to digest that. What was the startling revelation about the priesthood under the new covenant? That everybody in that covenant would be a priest. Remember that? That is kind of startling, isn't it? Everybody in the kingdom of God would be a priest. So, the characteristic, the greatest characteristic of this new temple, this new arrangement, would be holiness. And this measurement here is to make the point that here is the plan of God for holiness. Those who are going to participate in that are going to have to be holy. Look in chapter 44 now of Ezekiel over in verse 9. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, no foreigner, uncircumcised in heart and uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my sanctuary, or any foreigners that are among the children of Israel. You see that? No foreigner, uncircumcised in heart. Now, this is not merely emphasizing a physical Jew here, because it also says uncircumcised in heart. Several other passages that I think would be good for us to look at, because this is such a prominent theme. Look back in chapter 4 of Isaiah. Let's just look in Isaiah chapter 4. Isaiah chapter 4. Now, as in Isaiah, so often he's contrasting the present situation, the present sins, condemnation, with the future. So look in verse 2, when he looks to the future there in Isaiah 4, verse 2. In that day shall the branch of Jehovah be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. And it shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion. All right, now notice that, see. The one that is left in Zion, the one that's escaped of Israel. So the passage is saying not everybody's going to fit into this category. Those who escape, those that are left, he that remaineth in Jerusalem shall be called what? Holy. Say that again. He shall be called holy, even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem, and so on. Well, we could go on emphasizing that, but there are lots of verses that do emphasize that holiness is going to be the hallmark of this new arrangement that God is planning and that he's announcing in these prophets. Let's go to Zechariah now and notice the other passage where a reed is used to measure. So Zechariah chapter 2 and beginning in verse 1. And in this one, the man has a measuring line. Zechariah 2. And I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Then said I, Whither goest thou? And he said unto me, To measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof, and what is the length thereof. All right, now, you're going to measure the length thereof and the breadth thereof, so how would you go about doing that? You'd find where this side of town is, where the city limits is, and you'd measure from the city limits on that side to the city limits on the other side, east to west and maybe north to south. And in an ancient city, what would be the best frame of reference to measure? The wall. And then said I, Whither goest thou? To measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof and what is the length thereof. And behold, the angel that talked with me went forth, and another angel went out to meet him and said unto him, Run, speak to this young man, saying, because as he's about to measure, he needs to know something. Jerusalem shall be inhabited as villages without walls, by reason of the multitude of men and cattle therein. For I, saith the Lord, will be unto her a wall of fire round about, and I will be the glory in the midst of her. So you know what this is saying about the new spiritual Jerusalem? That it is going to be infinitely expandable. So there's no point going out there with your measuring line to measure how big is it going to be. It's going to be as big as it needs to be. It's not even going to have literal walls. Who's going to be the wall? Who's going to be the one to guard and so on? Jehovah, I will be unto her a wall of fire round about, and I will be the glory in the midst of her. So Zechariah, again, is one of these prophets who is setting forth the realities of this new arrangement that will exist in the days of the Messiah. So now when we come to Revelation, we are living in a time when that new arrangement has already been created. It has been inaugurated. Do you remember the last time we talked in chapter 10, and particularly, this is Revelation 10, particularly in verse 7, in the days of the voice of the seventh angel when he is about to sound, then is finished the mystery of God according to the good tidings which he declared to his servants, the prophets. Do you remember that we were pointing out that this is indisputably a reference to the prophet, the prophecies that God had made to the prophets of old? So this mystery, do you remember what we said? What was this mystery? What all did the mystery include? First of all, what are we talking about when we talk about this mystery? All right. And in the Old Testament, these were things that had not been revealed yet. But in the New Testament, they are completely revealed. Now, what were the features of this mystery? Because, see, the mystery is simply the plan that God had. I don't know why it is. There are certain words, I believe, that tend to blow the human mind. And I think mystery is one of them. Because every time we hear the word mystery, we just say, "Oh, mystery! Nobody knows that." But in the Bible, mystery refers to the plan of God, which at one time was not known, but was unfolded and revealed until finally it was all revealed. So in the revelation of the plan of God, what were the features of it? You can kind of take them in a logical order. The occurrence of sin, the promise and provision for redemption, the promise of the establishment of the kingdom of the Messiah, and in connection with that promise, the promise was made that in spite of the opposition of the nations, nevertheless, what would God succeed in doing with that kingdom of the Christ? And He would establish it, and it would stand. I think that one of the most notable examples of that is in Daniel 2, when you have the four empires symbolized by the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw and that Daniel then saw in the dream God revealed unto him, and in the interpretation of it, in the days of those kings, that is the kings of the fourth empire, in the days of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms. Is that not part of the mystery? Is that not part of the plan of God? And what was being shown here is that in spite of the opposition of men and in spite of the opposition of the nations, the kingdom of the Messiah would be absolutely established. But now in chapter 11, we're being told that it's not going to be easy. It is not going to be easy. And once again, we think about, you know, you take that Daniel 2:44, in the days of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these other kingdoms. You tie that with the second Psalm, you know, ask of me and I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance and the uttermost parts of thy possession of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them what? Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. So the prophets, as a part of that mystery that was revealed, while they showed that it's not going to be easy, that the nations will oppose God and they will oppose the Messiah, they will resist. Nevertheless, the kingdom will be established. So one said, there was given unto me a reed like unto a rod, and one said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. Now the purpose of this measuring is to make this point, and the court which is without the temple leave without and measure it not, for it hath been given unto the nations, and the holy city shall they tread under foot 42 months. All right, now let's just kind of take this a piece at the time. We're going to be encountering some periods of time mentioned here, like 42 months, and time times and half a time, and stuff like that. Now, the first thing we need to do is to exercise, as Jerry said early in our study, humility. And don't just jump in here and say, I have discovered exactly what this is, and I will nail it down for you. No, now there's no call for that. What we've got to do is to look at these terms and these figures and look at the way they're used and try to come up with a conclusion like that, that is consistent with all that we read about this. So we're going to kind of hang on to that a moment as we're thinking about the matter. But the first thing is, let's note the court which is without the temple. Now the temple here, the word temple here, is one of two words for temple that could be used. There is a word that you could use for temple that refers to the temple and the surroundings. But the word that is used here is the temple that refers to the building that includes the holy place and the most holy place. And that's all. This is the temple proper. So it is like the temple proper is inviolate. It cannot be invaded. It cannot be compromised. It cannot be taken. But that court which is around it, oh, the court can be defiled. The outside can be defiled. Now, there are two explanations that I have read about that that make sense to me, and I'm not sure which one it is. One is that the church may be persecuted, the saints may be afflicted, the saints may be killed by the political powers. But in so doing, they are not affecting the inner spiritual life of the church. Even when the saint is killed, if he is killed as a saint, blessed are they that, what? Remember that? Blessed are they that die in the Lord. So that's one idea. Another idea is that the temple is those Christians who are truly dedicated unto the Lord. And the court would be the idea of those Christians that are not thoroughly dedicated to the Lord. They are, you know, they're not real. They're hypocritical. I tend to lean to the first explanation. I really believe that what it's talking about is that the church may be persecuted, but it is in a way, the external church that is being persecuted, that can be afflicted, that can be harmed. The inner part, the temple itself, cannot be harmed. The court can be trampled. You know, I think about things like in the book of Acts, when Paul was brought before the Jewish council. I have a little string of things here I want you to just think about. These are those thoughts that I really enjoy because they kind of turn things upside down to what we typically think. Paul appears before the Jewish council, who's on trial. Our first impression is to say, Paul. But now who is on trial as far as God is concerned? It was the council. And when Paul appeared before Felix, Felix thought that who was on trial? Paul was on trial. In reality, who was on trial? Felix. You can even go back when Jesus appeared before Pilate. Who did Pilate think was on trial? Who was really on trial? Pilate. And so, yes, it may appear that the church is being harmed and afflicted and persecuted, and externally it is. But internally, no. I think that this is what God is saying here. Because we've got to remember these saints that were living at the time that were going through this persecution, that were being killed, that were having their relatives killed. What would give them comfort? To know that even though the external aspects of the church and of life could be affected by this persecution, the internal life of the church, the internal identity of the church could not be affected by these things. What did we find out has already happened? Remember, we like to go back occasionally to Revelation 7, where we are shown a great multitude that cannot be numbered. Where are they? They're standing before the throne of God and the Lamb. And how are they dressed? Dressed in their white robes and so, you see Stephen, how must he have looked in the last moments of his life? And as he lay there, a bloody corpse. And so externally, everybody would say, oh, no, look, this is terrible. Or I wonder how James looked after he had been beheaded in Acts 12. That would have been a sad sight. And everybody could have said, how are we going to bear this? How are we going to bear this? And so God says, well, in the first place, remember, this is not the reality of the thing. This is just the external. Let me show you what Stephen's doing. Let me show you what James is doing. And then we see them in Revelation 7. Wouldn't that help? Would that not help a persecuted people? I think that's what God is telling here. In the midst of this terrible ordeal that they're going through, He is telling them that it's only the externals that are involved in this. Those things that are truly a part of the holy temple, they are inviolate. And in verse 2, when He also says, the holy city shall they tread underfoot 40 and 2 months. The only conclusion I can make there is that that is being made parallel to the courts of the temple. There are two things that are going to be trodden. First, the courts that are without the temple. It will be given unto the nations. And the holy city shall they tread underfoot 40 and 2 months. So I think that the idea of the courts is merged with the idea of the externals. The externals. They will be trampled underfoot. But the temple itself will be inviolate. Okay, so let me just stop there for that for a moment, having expressed that idea before we now look at verse 3 and also the 42 months and so on. Before we look at that, anyone have a point you'd like to add or a comment you would like to make about this distinction? Yeah, Jerry? Right.
They are protected. But the message there is, in response to the question, how long until for events, and there'll be another period of time.
Right.
Or if your brother has suffered the same thing and been killed, even you have been. And I wonder if there's not in the building of that same thought that you've come to chapter 11. Now, there are those that are in God's protection at the time.
Right.
They're the martyred saints. And there will be no more harm coming.
Right. Right. Right.
Right.
Right.
They suffer that too. And I wonder if that might be part of the thought here. So
there are
those, in other words, this continues to unfold, it's not over yet.
That's right.
Even as we see on chapter 11, now, there's going to be more suffering, more conflict between the witnesses, between God's people.
That's right. I think that's it. I think that's exactly right. And as he goes on here talking about these witnesses, I think that's exactly what he's going to be explaining to us. That's right. So it will tie in with what we have seen in 6. And actually, you know, you can also say, look at the comments made in the 7 letters, you know, to those like Antipas, my faithful witness, who had been killed. And, you know, you've got others like that. So this whole thing. And we've got to remember that these people to whom this was written were people who were dying, and their loved ones were dying, and their leaders were dying. They were being put to death. And any time that kind of thing is going on, it is awfully easy to say, hey, we're losing. Isn't it? We're losing. And while God is saying, no, you're not losing. And so I think you're right. In 11, now he goes on pointing out that this, the kind of thing you're experiencing, it's going to go on, but you're not going to lose. You're not only not going to lose, neither is the kingdom going to be destroyed. Instead, it's going to be established, and it will survive. All right, now, when you look at the 42 months, I do not believe that there is any kind of a literal significance that can be given to that 42 months. And when we read about the time, times, and half a time, both we read about it in Daniel and we read about it here, the only way in the world I have any clue what time, times, and half a time would be to compare it with 42 months. And it happens that if we say that the time there is a year, and we have a time, a year, times 2 years, and a half a time, 3.5 years, well, it would happen that in a kind of an idealized year of 12 months and so on, that would be 42 months. So the best estimate that I would have is that we would equate the time, times, and half a time with the 42 months. But again, this is not where our emphasis needs to be. All this is saying is that for a time, it's going to appear that the forces of persecution are in the ascendancy. that they are winning. But during that same time, well, for example, just jump on over one page to Revelation 12, where this woman that delivers the man-child and everything looks like it's just pretty well all over for both the woman and the man-child that's delivered. Well, the man-child is delivered, and instead of the red dragon being able to eat him up, her child was caught up unto God and unto His throne. Verse 5, out of the reach, totally out of the reach of the dragon. What about the woman? Verse 6, the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that there they may nourish her 1,260 days. Guess how long that is? If you put that into 30-day months, then it works out 42 months, 3.5 years. So I believe that we have pretty good evidence to say that the 42 months, the 3.5 years, and the 1,260 days would all work out to be the same symbolic length of time, which would be, this is how long it's going to be, a period of time when the church is going to be suffering persecution at the hands of its enemies. It is going to appear that perhaps the enemies of the Lord are in the ascendancy. But it's also going to be the time when the Lord is going to protect His people so that they are not exterminated. They will not be exterminated. So I think that that's what those periods of time are talking about. I don't believe that those periods of time represent the whole gospel age. I don't think they represent the whole gospel age. If that was what it was talking about, then that would be telling... That would be telling these people that are being persecuted and everything right now, hey, hang on, this is going to be all over in a little while. You know, when the whole gospel age is over, well, thanks a lot. No, it's not when the whole gospel age is over. It is when this period of persecution, when this period when it appears that the enemies of God are, it looks like they've got the upper hand. No, they don't have the upper hand. No, they don't have the upper hand. It appears they have the upper hand. But the victory is going to be yours. You will win. And you will win whether you live or whether you die. Didn't Paul have something to say about that? You remember what he said? For me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. So I offer that as an explanation, that I think that that's what this is saying. To me, it is thoroughly in keeping with the message of the book of Revelation, in completely in connection with all of the these prophecies and so on. Let's look at the witnesses for a moment. Two witnesses. Why two? I have one reason I can give you, and that is that in the law, how many witnesses did it take to make testimony valid? Two. When Jesus sent His apostles out on the limited commission, He sent them out two by two. So I don't think there's any significance to the two witnesses except that the very fact they are witnesses, there are two to indicate that their testimony is valid. Now, who are these witnesses? The witnesses are those who give the testimony of God's will. These are the ones who bear witness that this is what God says, this is His will. They prophesy 1,260 days. In other words, during that same period when the church is being established, when it is undergoing persecution, and all of this, the revelation of God, the testimony of God is being delivered by these men. These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the Lord of the earth. Now, here is another allusion. This allusion goes back to Zechariah. And in Zechariah, the point that is being made, let's see, we have just a few more minutes. I think we have time enough. Let's go on back to to Zechariah and look for just a moment at Zechariah 4. And be prepared for the fact that when you look at the prophetic allusions that you see in John compared to Zechariah or compared to Ezekiel or one of the other prophets, be prepared for the fact that there may be a slight alteration in the way that figure is used. It's just like the man with a measuring reed. You know, really, the point being made about the man with the measuring reed or the measuring line, the point was slightly different. Really, it was slightly different in all three cases. Well, here, let's begin in verse 1. The angel that talked with me came again and waked me as a man that is wakened out of his sleep. And he said unto me, "What seest thou?" And I said, "I have seen and behold a candlestick all of gold with its bowl upon the top of it and its seven lamps thereon. There are seven pipes to each of them." Wait a minute. What does an olive oil lamp have to burn? Got to have oil. "And the two olive trees," you see two olive trees here. "And two olive trees by it, one upon the right side of the bowl, the other upon the left side of the bowl. And I answered and spake to the angel that talked with me, saying, 'What are these, my Lord?' Then the angel that talked with me answered and said unto me, 'Knowest thou not what these are?' I said, 'No, my Lord.' Then he answered and spake unto me, saying, 'This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel.'" This is the word of the Lord. The thing to be emphasized there is this is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel. The emphasis here is not upon Zerubbabel. "This is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, 'Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit.'" Do you see in that context? What is all of this about the oil that is perpetually being supplied by the olive trees into the candlestick? What is this? This is holy men spake as they were moved by the Holy Spirit. This is the idea of the inspiration of God by His Spirit accomplishing His will and so on. And so what we've got over here, the two olive trees, but you see in verse 4, instead of two candlesticks, back in Zechariah, how many candlesticks was it? Do you remember? It was one back in Zechariah. But that's okay. He is merely using that same kind of a figure to tell us, listen, it's simple. What's he saying about these two witnesses? They're inspired. They're inspired of God. They're being given the message they preach from God Himself. These are the two witnesses. They are standing before the Lord of the earth. And if any man desireth to hurt them... Now this part is fun. It's really fun to me. And I want you to join with me. And let's see if we can kind of pick out who this would be. Because these are allusions to prophets of God of old. "If any man desireth to hurt them, fire proceeds out of their mouth." You remember a prophet that enemies were sent to get, and fire came out from before the Lord and devoured them? Remember Elijah sitting on the hill, and remember Ahaziah sinning? Okay. "And if any man shall desire to hurt them, in this manner must he be killed. These have the power to shut the heaven, that it rain not during the days of their prophecy." Now who would that be? That it rain not? Elijah. To shut the heavens that it rain not during the days of their prophecy. "They have the powers over the waters to turn them into blood." Now, who turned the water to blood? What prophet or man was that? Moses, remember? "And to smite the earth with every plague as often as they shall desire." So it's kind of a collage here, isn't it? Of inspired men, great prophets of old that God used to deliver His testimony. His testimony to Pharaoh, or His testimony to Ahab, or His testimony to Ahaziah. In the face of the most formidable people and situations. "And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that cometh up out of the abyss shall make war with them and overcome them and kill them." And that means that, you know, it's true. Even in the Old Testament, we can think about prophets We can think about prophets who were not miraculously delivered like Moses was and like Elijah was. Is that the first bell? First bell. See, we can think of them, but can we also think of men and prophets of the Old Testament who were not miraculously delivered, but they died? And we think in Acts 12. We think in Acts 7 where Stephen died. We think in Acts 12 of where James was beheaded. Sometimes we say, why would God deliver Elijah, but He would let James, the first apostle, be killed? Why would He let him be killed? Well, that's within the realm of what God does. I don't know. But God protects His witnesses, His people. They get the job done. And as they have finished their testimony, the beast comes up out of the abyss to make war with them, overcomes them, kills them. And how does the world feel? Hey, we have defeated them. We have overcome the kingdom of the Lord. Well, that's a good place to stop, isn't it? Because next time we'll find out the truth.